I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. In a state controlled by Republicans, what's a Democrat to do? Well, we'll hear from Florida Representative Scott Randolph of Orlando. He's the new rising star among Florida Democrats. Plus, Orlando Sentinel columnist Beth Kassib discusses the NBA All-Star Game, Pine Hills, and a missing Central Florida woman that you haven't heard about. Those conversations coming up next on Intersection. Scott Randolph is a rising star among Florida Democrats. He's a state house representative from Orlando and chair of the Orange County Democratic Party. He got a lot of attention for suggesting on the House floor that his wife incorporate her uterus because of Republican measures to deregulate business. But Randolph is looking bigger than just that. He's trying to undo some of the state GOP dominance in Florida. He'll talk with me about how he's hoping to do that. And it's my pleasure to welcome Scott Randolph to Intersection.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Talk to me a big picture here for a minute. Florida's governor, the cabinet, many, many posts across the state, especially here in Central Florida, are dominated by Republicans. And especially when you look at those state elected offices, it's Republican all the way through. So what is the role of the Democratic Party when you have Republicans controlling so many of the levers of power?
Well, the current role, I think, of the minority party, the Democrats right now, especially in the state legislature, is to continue to bring attention to the policies that are going on in Tallahassee and within that work where we can to kill bills. It's sort of difficult sometimes when I come home after a session and I tell people, I had a great session because I killed legislation. It's not like the majority is going to let you pass anything very substantive coming from the minority party. But look, there's some important legislation out there that we've been able to kill and maim in the last two or three sessions.
And tell me, what do you see as you ramp up towards 2012 for Democrats to be able to do as they get ready to challenge these Republicans who are holding the levers of power in Tallahassee and locally here in terms of trying to gain back some control?
Well, I think, first of all, fair districts at the state and the congressional level will do a lot to make that happen. So I hope the courts will really fulfill the goals of 5 and 6 in both letter and spirit of those amendments. And I think that will go a long way. Because once we have fair districts and where politicians aren't choosing the voters, but voters are choosing the politicians, I think the Democratic message about protecting and expanding the middle class and protecting and working for the guy that gets up and the woman that gets up and goes to work every day and not the big corporations, that message will get through better because we'll be able to recruit candidates. When you're in gerrymandered districts, here's what gerrymandering really does and how it hurts the political process. It not only gives a party overwhelming majority, but then there's fewer districts that are competitive. So it's difficult to create a bench of good candidates because you're not going to get a good candidate in a race where the Democratic performance is down 15 points.
It looks like a losing proposition.
Yeah. It takes a lot to campaign. So that, and then as you get fewer and fewer competitive seats, all the money flows into a few seats. So like in the last decade, basically, even in the state house where there's 120 seats, all 120 are up every 2 years, there were maybe 7, 8, if you were lucky, 10 competitive seats. And that's really, quite frankly, a stretch. Really, 5 to 7 was the average of really competitive seats. So you saw huge money flow into these seats. And so a state house race, now the Republicans in a competitive state house race will throw $1 million at a state house race. And the Democrats, maybe if they're lucky, will spend $300,000 or $400,000. And so normal people, regular people, golly, how do you tell them to go out and raise that kind of cash? How do normal people run for office? And they don't. And it really shuts the door to a lot of good candidates.
We're talking with Scott Randolph. He's Democratic representative for Orlando and chair of the Orange County Democratic Party. Let me ask you, Scott, what's your relationship like with Lou Oliver, who's your Republican counterpart here in Orange County? He's a pretty sharp guy and has been around the block for a while. Do you ever see eye to eye on things?
Not very often. I actually don't speak to him. In fact, I don't think I've ever spoken to him. For all I know, you could be Lou Oliver.
I am not.
There you go. So, well, that's good. But no, I honestly have no interaction with him.
Is that typical for county parties not to?
Well, I just came into this job in November, so it wasn't I had no reason, I guess, to interact with him beforehand, and I've not had that chance to do so yet.
Let me ask you also a kind of a big picture. President Barack Obama and Michelle Obama have been hitting Central Florida pretty hard in recent months.
Finally.
The president visited Walt Disney World. He was unveiling a new tourism initiative. And recently, First Lady Michelle Obama was in Central Florida talking about healthy lifestyles and better food, that sort of thing. U.S. Senator Bill Nelson, though, when the president was at Disney, was not there, even though he's in this really competitive race for re-election with U.S. Representative Connie Mack, who seems to be coming to the forefront on the GOP side. Looking at the trend that maybe Mr. Nelson was setting, do you think President Obama helps or hurts Democrats with these appearances in local and state races at this point?
Well, I think he helps, and I really do think that was a scheduling conflict. And I know the public doesn't buy scheduling conflicts, but I don't, you know, they tried to get me to attend the event as well, and I was up in Tallahassee, and they didn't confirm the details literally until like 24 hours beforehand. So I do honestly believe that was a scheduling conflict. Now, if it continues to happen, maybe we take a different approach as to whether what's going on. But I think obviously Obama's a help. Obama's a help because it's a motivation issue. And I always tell Democrats when I go out and I talk to Democratic groups around the state, you will never wake up on the day after an election and see a headline that says there was massive voter turnout and Democrats lost. I've never seen that headline ever. It is always, there was low voter turnout. Nobody came out to vote. Republicans won. And if you do some really simple math, you get there. So 81% of eligible adults are even registered to vote. In the last governor's election, 47% of voters came out to vote. Of that, Rick Scott got 49% of the vote. So basically, Rick Scott got 18% of adults in Florida to vote for him, and that's how he became governor. We've got it. So what Obama does is motivate voters. When you have a big top of the ticket like that, you're going to motivate voters. And that's what Democrats need in 2012 and what we didn't have in 2010.
Do you think that President Obama can take Florida again in his reelection bid?
I think the biggest challenge that we have is the voter suppression law that the Republicans passed, HB 1355.
You're talking about new regulations for people who end up wanting to change their voting registration and what types of ID they need to bring.
Three or four big things. Severely restricting third-party organizations
and groups
to register to vote.
This is groups like the League of Women Voters who've said they're going to end their registration campaign because of this new law.
And the media on the teacher that wanted to register her students to vote in their classroom.
Right, and there's new restrictions on the amount of time it is to turn those.
Exactly, and other and registering with the state and telling people who you are, telling the state who you are. So imagine, I mean, it's the biggest infringement on First Amendment that I've ever seen to tell the state that you want to go out and register your neighbor. Because under that law, if I were literally to slide you a voter registration form right now, I violated the law because I didn't register with the state before I slid you. Not if I had no plans to go anywhere else, just me and you, one-on-one, and I slid you that voter registration card, I became a third-party voter registration group that has to file massive amounts of paperwork with the state. The strategy behind this was that, look, low-income, renters, young people, they tend to move. You tend to continue to have to re-register them, and the Republicans know that. And so they intentionally attack that. There's a study out of the University of Florida on the other changes about early voting and some of the others. Oh, and updating your voter registration at the polls. Statistically speaking, attacked Hispanic and African-American and young voters. And so that bill had the true intent and the result of going after Democratic voters. So our first challenge in winning Florida is overcoming that, either through invalidating that law or finding some way to continue to get people to register to vote.
You've been getting a lot of attention as a rising star in the Democratic Party, but your wife, Susanna Randolph, is also a rising figure in Democratic circles. Together, you've been described as Central Florida's progressive power couple. She is head of Florida Watch Action and has worked with Acorn and Clean Water Action before in the past, and also was heavily involved with Alan Grayson in helping to run his re-election bid, which failed against Dan Webster. But what role does she have in your political career?
I am lucky to have a wife like Susanna. And it really is true. In the article when they said we wake up and think about politics, We really do. I couldn't imagine a more perfect spouse for me, because it's sort of funny. We were thinking the other day, we're like, we don't have a lot of couple friends. And they were like, that's because we talk politics literally 24 hours a day. I don't know who could stand to be around us to do that. But Susanna has a big role. And I joke, but it's very true, that often she is the one that gets speaking requests from around the state. And I tag along with her. She tags along with me. I'd say in the last 6 months, we've probably been to at least 25 different counties around this state speaking to various Democratic groups.
Now, you got a lot of attention last spring when you suggested on the floor of the Florida House that your wife incorporate her uterus because of Republican measures to deregulate business. That is a very brave approach to take, I think, for anybody, especially a political figure like yourself. But why take that approach? And obviously, you had to get the sign off of your wife before reaching this on the floor, I would imagine.
And I will say that we actually discussed it. It was actually something that she said to me. And I thought, that's an interesting look at this. Because Republicans always say that they're for small government. But it always seems it's small government for the big corporations and it's big government for the little guy. They constantly want to overregulate people's personal lives and women's personal choices. The issue of choice is extremely personal and huge, that things in life are too complicated that government can sit there and dictate to people how to live their lives. And so we were taught, last year was all about deregulating all these professions around the state. And yet at the same time, we had 18 anti-choice bills going through the legislature. And so it was amazing to me that, the Republicans were constantly, we should deregulate this business to be smaller government. And at the same time, getting bigger government into the lives of women and the lives of couples. And so, I suggested, you know what, the only way that you would finally stay out of my wife's life is if she were to incorporate her uterus so that she could be a business in this state and maybe you'd finally deregulate it.
Your name has been floated as a contender for state chair of the Democratic Party. Is that a position you'd like to hold?
I am definitely looking at that. I go into my last term, hopefully. Obviously, redistricting matters, and I'll have a big election coming up. But after that, then the state party chair, when Rod Smith steps down, will come open. And I certainly, our travels around the state for the last 6 months have put me in the position, I think, to meet a lot of people. And I would like to run for state party chair. And I've talked about that openly since that article sort of suggested it. I guess, well, the cat's out of the bag. So because I think, as we discussed, and Karen Thurman moved the ball. Rod Smith's moving the ball. And the next party chair has got to come from an angle of, I think I bring that angle of elected official, an activist, and fundraiser at the same time. And you bring all that and campaigner. You bring all that together, and I think that's what you need in a state party chair. And you need somebody in Central Florida where this is where the votes are at that we need to win statewide elections. They are not in North Florida as much as they are right here in Central Florida.
Let me ask you about a couple of potential political races here. Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer running for governor?
I would not be surprised, and I think it would be a very interesting election. Look, the last two Democratic candidates have come out of Tampa. Actually, the last three, two of them from the same family. But it shows the importance of the I-4 corridor. And we've not had a candidate from Orlando in a very long time. And I think Orlando would be a fantastic spot for a Democratic candidate.
What about Charlie Crist, the former governor, running as a Democratic for governor or maybe for U.S. Congress?
You probably saw. Thanks for not saying my eyes were rolling as you were saying. I have heard his name for Congress. I think it would be difficult for him to make it through a Democratic primary. People do not appreciate party switchers. And I think it's difficult for him politically without saying anything about whether he'd be good or bad. He ran as a Republican in 06. An independent in 2010 and 10, and then as a Democrat in 2014, I think that's very difficult politically. And I think also 2010 showed that when he left the Republican Party, his fundraising really dried up. And so I don't know what kind of fundraising he could actually bring as a Democratic candidate to the Democratic race.
Well, people always ask. He works for John Morgan, who, of course, is a big Democratic backer. And every time President Obama comes to Orlando and meets with John Morgan, people look to see if Charlie Crist is there.
You still need statewide. And certainly, yeah, I keep looking, too. And I haven't seen it yet, not that I'm at very many of those events. I don't have an extra $30,000 sitting around on my coffee table to donate. But I have not seen him show up at Democratic events yet.
Scott Randolph, help me wrap up. What's ahead for the legislative session? We only got about 3 weeks left.
Well, I think the big thing, obviously, the budget. And you'll see that I think after a lot of pressure from parents, there's a lot of talk in Tallahassee about replacing some of the money that was cut from education last year. About $1.7 billion was cut when you throw in the pension money from teachers. They are proposing to spend increase spending by $900 million. But much of that, they're proposing to go to charter schools, and they're proposing that really just goes to the growth of the students in there. So there's not really that much more in education. The big thing locally is what they call the Expedia bill, the online travel company bill, where they've been cheating us on taxes.
And this is something that the county has been trying to deal with for a while.
Yes. Well, there's been a lot of litigation all over the country on this. And so they keep coming into state legislatures trying to find their own legislative fix so that they can continue to cheat us on taxes. That's huge. We've got it bottled up in finance and tax, where I'm the ranking Democrat, thanks to some bipartisan support from some Republicans. And so I don't think that bill is going to move forward.
I've been speaking with Florida Representative Scott Randolph. He is chair of the Orange County Democratic Party, and you're going to be back up in Tallahassee for the legislative session, so have a great time.
Fantastic.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Coming up next on Intersection, Orlando Sentinel columnist Beth Kassab talks about her new column focusing on Central Florida's suburbs. Beth Kassab is the Orlando Sentinel's new local columnist. She replaces Mike Thomas, who stepped down last year. Kassab focuses on the suburbs in her column. She writes about things like transportation, healthcare, education, politics, and most importantly, how all these issues apply to residents in Central Florida. Beth Kassab joins me to talk about her new column. Great to have you in.
Thanks, Mark.
You used to write a lot about business for the Sentinel. How is the shift going from doing that kind of reporting into being a columnist and developing a voice, which as a reporter, you kind of tend to want to diminish your own voice and rely mostly on facts?
Sure. You know, that is a big transition. And any reporter that moves from being a straight up news reporter to being a columnist will probably find that transition pretty liberating in a lot of ways. It's actually really nice to be able to put your own stamp and your own imprint on the reporting you're doing. I loved being a reporter. That's something I enjoyed. And I was a reporter at the Sentinel for a good 8 years or so before I started writing columns. But like you said, I moved from the business desk. And again, kind of liberating in the sense that my column now covers so many topics. It's so wide ranging. It's, you know, I learn something new every day.
So, Beth, one of the topics that you really like to focus in is on the suburbs. And you yourself are from the burbs. Over in Oviedo is where you're living right now. So why do you think the suburbs are so important to you, and how does your perspective living in them shape that?
Well, they're certainly important just right off the bat because of the population base and because there's so many people living there. I think it's really incumbent on us to pay more attention. And over the years, as the Sentinel hasn't put as much focus on the burbs, I think we need to try to reinstate that as best we can, whenever we can. So that's one of the things I'm trying to do. Not every column certainly is about the suburbs, but it's an issue that's really near and dear to me. You mentioned I live in Oviedo now, and that's true. I live there with my husband and our two small kids. And I grew up in the suburbs right here in Central Florida, too. So I lived in Longwood, graduated from Lake Brantley High School. So that's really been my life. And I think that's the case for a lot of people who live here.
You know, another local issue that you've written about is the effort in Pine Hills to hang banners like we see in different communities around Orlando along main corridors. And Pine Hills just opened the new Evans High School in that area. And, of course, people wanted to turn out, and there was a parade down by the high school, and people wanted the streetscape to look really nice with those decorative banners like you see along the Mills Ave corridor in Orlando. But the Orlando Utilities Commission kind of pushed back on that effort, citing safety and liability issues, even concerns that the banners might block streetlights. And you wrote that's one of the silliest things you've ever heard.
That's right. There seem to be just plain obstinance going on in this particular case. And that's really another story of, again, I think a very impressive group of neighborhood residents who wanted to better their community and were trying to do a very, very simple thing. And they ran into one roadblock after the next. And I found out about it, and I went and spent some time with them and toured around with them and interviewed them. And you know, the column I ended up getting out of it was really focusing on this banner issue, because it seemed like such an issue, a simple issue to solve. And as a matter of fact, after that column ran, the next week, OUC did come to the table, and now the county and OUC are kind of finalizing arrangements that will let these banners eventually go up.
How do you find out about a local story like that?
It's really sourcing. That's the most important thing to me, is are the contacts that I have in the community. And that doesn't mean I go to the same contacts all the time, although there are people that I stay in very regular contact with. In the case of the Pine Hills story, I'll just give you that as an example. The gentleman who's one of the lead organizers for the Pine Hills Community Council, I had written a story about an effort that group was involved in probably, you know, it might have been even 5 or 6 years ago. It was some time ago. And, you know, he's been nice enough to stay in email contact with me. And I knew there were some interesting things going on there, and Pine Hills is one of Orlando's original suburbs. And so, you know, he was nice enough to invite me out, and I really wanted to find out more. And when I did, that's just one column idea that, you know, I've been able to get in the paper so far, but there's certainly more.
So, Beth Kassab, you've been also writing about issues going on in downtown Orlando, particularly as they pertain to the new Amway Arena and the businesses around it, and this NBA All-Star game that's coming up in just a little bit here. So read from us a little bit about that column.
Sure. Those poor Church Street merchants. For years, that's been a popular refrain as a group of plucky shop owners endured the construction of the new Amway Center, a 2-year ordeal that shut down streets and isolated their businesses. Then there was the NBA lockout, which kept the arena dark for the first 2 months of this season. Those poor merchants. But the sympathy is starting to wane. The merchants' latest cries of injustice seem more manufactured for a big payday than a plea for fairness. Are we really supposed to feel sorry that one of their biggest and glitziest sporting events in America is about to happen steps outside their storefronts? The NBA All-Star Weekend set for the end of this month should be a shopkeeper's dream. But some of the merchants are demanding $3.5 million in compensation for their hardship. And get this, they want 2 tickets each to the exclusive All-Star Weekend events, tickets worth thousands of dollars apiece. Give me a break. If the 11 tenants on the ground level of the city-owned parking garage on that block split $3.5 million evenly, that would equal more than $318,000 each. That's more profit than most of these businesses see in an entire year, much less one weekend.
How do you determine, I guess, who's the good guy and who's the bad guy in these situations? Because, you know, as a reporter myself, I know if you go down and you talk to the city and you say, hey, you know, all these businesses are concerned about this, what are you going to do? They come forward and they say, like you described, we've been helping to subsidize rents, and we've been, you know, in communications with them, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it's you have to take that into account, into the story. So do you have to guard against leaning into the sympathies of people who feel like they're being victimized?
Yeah, for me, it's not so much about picking a good guy or a bad guy. It's just about presenting what's going on in a way that people can understand it. And really, even though I write a column and I insert a lot of opinion into the column, really at the end of the day, I'm still providing people information, and people are still free to draw their own conclusions. So they don't necessarily agree with me. And I can tell you, a lot of people don't agree with me. I get those emails every day. But, you know, so it's not necessarily about picking a winner or a loser. It's really about presenting things in the most clear way that I can. And in the case of the arena and the merchants, you know, the city has done a lot for those merchants. That they were cut breaks on rent. The city has invested over $300,000 into grants for those merchants to help them renovate their shops and make other improvements. And, you know, this latest ask by the merchants, which the kind of collective ask was for $3.5 million and two tickets each to the NBA All-Star Weekend. You know, that just that seemed like an overreach.
One column that you wrote that really grabbed my attention was when you wrote about Stephanie Edwards, who's a 50-year-old Winter Park woman who vanished in 2010. This was around the same time there was a lot of focus going on about Michelle Parker, a 33-year-old mother who vanished last year after appearing on the People's Court, and that case really drew a lot of media attention. But the point that you made was that this other woman, Stephanie Edwards from Winter Park, who also disappeared, just really wasn't getting a lot of attention, and you decided to shine a little more light on that case. Why did you decide to pick that one up?
Well, as you mentioned, Michelle Parker, and that case had been getting so much attention. And I really set out to tell the story of another mom who had gone missing and had not been getting that level of attention. And so I started researching old cases. I started, a lot of them were cases that had turned cold. I started researching newer cases, and that's when I came across Stephanie Edwards' case. And like you mentioned, that's a case out of Winter Park. And the thing that struck me about Stephanie's case is that from the facts that were in the police report and the facts that the detectives are aware of, it's very obvious that something horrible has happened to this woman. She literally vanished off the street, just completely disappeared from her neighborhood where she had been for quite some time. And the fact that something so terrible had happened and that it was getting so little attention struck me, and I felt like I just had to write a column about it.
And I think we should point out here that Stephanie Edwards is black and Michelle Parker is white. Do you think that played a role?
Oh, yes. Not necessarily. I guess I don't see it so much as a racial issue. I really see it as a class issue. I think more important than the fact that Stephanie Edwards was or is black is that she was poor and she was a little bit older and she didn't have a lot of beautiful glamour shots for the TV news crews or even the Orlando Sentinel to flash in front of viewers. In fact, I point out in the column that the police had just her driver's license photo to work with. And it was really quite an unbecoming photo, unfortunately, as many of our driver's license photos are. So her case was disadvantaged in a lot of ways in terms of getting a lot of – in terms of how much attention it was getting. And I just felt like there was a real injustice in that. And I – you know, hey, I'm in the media and I'm a huge proponent of – the good that newspapers and television stations can do. But in this column, I called them out. I felt like they weren't doing their job.
I've been speaking with Orlando Sentinel columnist Beth Cassip. Beth, thanks for talking to us.
Well, thanks for having me.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. You can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.